gain convincing evidence that inflation happens, and why practically this might be a little bit of a challenge. So this is work done as part of the Doubling Up Science team, which I joined a year ago. This wasn't introduced then, but this is all work that's been done either last year or is guiding our work in progress at the moment. So the team is still small, not many of us, and it's still based in basically predominantly two institutions. First in Princeton, where there's a group of us here, or the people in grey have left the team now, and in the NASA Goddard Center, where there's a large group of people working on the project. Chuck Bennett's the PI, and he's moved to Johns Hopkins, where he's got two new postdocs, Ben and David, and there's also a group of research at different institutions. But we're still a pretty small team, and we're hard at work analyzing 5 years of WAMP data now, which I'm not going to show you today, but that's what we're hard at work doing right now. But onto the challenges of inflation. Just to talk about first what we're trying to get at, what we're trying to measure, and how. A reminder that inflationary paradigm is extension of the standard Big Bang model. The idea is, and it's an effective field theory only, and the idea is the universe underwent this period of exponential expansion, driven by the potential of some inflaton field, which we don't know what that is yet, but could be some single inflaton field. And this expansion lasted for more than 60 e-folds, and it stretched a tiny volume to a region much larger than the observed universe today. The paradigm was introduced in the 80s to address three main problems. Why is the universe so flat, or apparently geometrically flat? The horizon problem of why there are regions in causal contact that wouldn't be if this scenario wasn't in place, and why there are no magnetic monopoles in the universe. Conveniently, it also provides a mechanism for seeding structure in the universe by laying down inflation, perturbations at early times that will then grow by gravitational instability to form structure that we see in the universe today. So this paradigm has had a lot of triumph so far. Nothing that it has predicted has so far not been seen if it should have been seen. Even though there are obviously different ways that we can tweak the model to say different things about it. The predictions it makes that have either been seen or not seen so far are firstly that we should see maybe scale invariant fluctuations. There should be, if the fluctuations were laid down during inflation, there should be approximately equal power at different scales. And this was seen using CMB experiments initially by Kobe back in the 1990s. Inflation predicts that the universe should be flat or very, very close to flat. And this was initially seen by early experiments in the late 90s and around 2000 by Boomerang, Maxima, CMB experiments, and confirmed even more so by WMAP in combination with other cosmological data sets. There's still some freedom in the CMB to not be completely flat. If inflation is driven by a single field, and no other scale of fields messing things up at early times, the fluctuation should be adiabatic. The data is completely consistent with them being adiabatic, and has been since experiments, Boomerang, CBI, Maxima, CMB experiments around 2000 and by WMAP too. Now there's also, it's possible to have non-adiabatic fluctuations. This is work that I was involved with Constantinos in Oxford. And you still can have non-adiabatic fluctuations that fit current data. But essentially, the data is consistent with it being adiabatic. We expect to see super horizon fluctuations, which we've seen evidence of in the first of WMAP data. They should be Gaussian, and they seem to be. it's a very good accuracy. We also, then, the last two are the kind of interesting fun ones that are just in progress now, that we expect the spectral index of fluctuations to be less than one, which means we expect there to be slightly less power on small scales than at large scales if they were really laid down by inflation. Now, I put a twiddle there because even though people have been grandly saying we've seen that NS is, the spectral index is less than one, it's like a 2.5 signal detection. It's the best fit models have expected index of less than one, but I think we still need more data to really gain that convincing knowledge. Now, the thing we're really after are gravitational waves. We haven't seen them yet, and they're what we really want to see to get really good confidence that inflation happened. So why do we expect gravitational waves? So if we had a scenario that we have a slowly rolling single field in the simplest inflationary models, we've got quantum fluctuations of that inflaton field inside the horizon during inflation, and they're then stretched super horizon and imprinted to then grow by gravitational collapse once they have re-entered the horizon as the universe expands. This process will imprint both scalar and tensor perturbations to the metric. And if it was this scenario of a single field slowly rolling, we'd expect to get this specific ratio, the ratio of tensor perturbations to scalar perturbations, these are the power in each of the two types of perturbations to the metric, proportional or a function of the potential of that inflaton field in this simpler scenario. So we'd expect to get these two kinds of perturbations, and then we note that the tensor perturbations don't couple to density perturbations. So if you have these tensor perturbations, they don't then couple to density perturbations and grow. They just simply propagate as waves in the space-time metric. Now, still, let's assume that it is a single field. It might not be. If the potential of this inflaton can be characterized by, for example, a V of phi, where phi is the inflaton field, goes as phi squared, and if there were 60 e-folds inflation, then we'd expect a tensor scalar ratio of 0.13. Now, that this is all. Could be much more than that. This is an optimistic scenario, but we still expect them to be there at some level if they can happen. Now, how do we go about detecting them? We use the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so what's going on is we've got a recombination after 300,000 years. The universe cools enough for atoms to combine. But while that process is going on, we've got Thomson scattering of photons of free electrons during the recombination process. And now, if you've got an electron here, and if you have a temperature quadrupole around that electron, which basically means you've got more photons coming in this way than this way, then once they scatter off that electron, the polarization going out in that direction, the light would be polarized if there was more light coming in originally this way than this way. We polarize in this direction. So we can go and look at the CMB and see if it's polarized to detect if we have this initial pattern, this quadrupole pattern of in the temperature. The trouble is you get this specific pattern from two different mechanisms. You get it from, first of all, just simply the density perturbations from scalar perturbations near the universe. They will, as the universe recombines and as you start getting free streaming, basically the photon barrier fluid has these density perturbations set up from these acoustic waves, and you get the specific pattern incident on electrons from the density perturbations in the photon barrier fluid. But you also get, if you have gravitational waves around, you also get the specific pattern that will induce polarization. You have a quadrupole. So we want to distinguish between those two because they'll be mixed up completely. So if we go and measure the polarization, we want to be able to actually extract that specific signal. And how we do it is whenever we go and measure polarization, we measure it in terms of Q and U Stokes vectors. So if we take our sky, we'll be measuring the polarization where, for example, we're measuring a Q Stokes vector, we measure the polarization in this direction. And a U Stokes vector will measure it in this direction. So 45 degrees to Q. But that obviously completely depends on where you choose to define your coordinate system. So we can decompose any measurement of Q and U polarization into E and B modes, where an E mode is a divergence-like quantity, and a B mode is a vorticity-like quantity. So we can write any field which has Q and U Stokes vectors. We can decompose it into spin two spherical harmonics with both E modes and B modes, like this. And with the temperature, we just simply decompose that into standard spherical harmonics with their amplitudes. Since scalar perturbations don't have a curl free by construction, they don't produce any B modes. So we can then say, roughly speaking, these equal signs are taking liberties a little bit, but if we see any B mode in polarization, we can then say that this must have come from gravitational waves, must come from tensor perturbations. And if we see them, then it's good evidence for inflation. There are obviously caveats there that if we see B modes, they might have come from somewhere else that's not cosmological. They might also have come from lensing of the scalar perturbation E mode by intervening matter along the path to us. And then we might come up with some different ideas of why gravitational waves could tell us that it's inflation. But essentially, this is the kind of like thing where we think might be right. Okay, so what do we actually see? So this is actually going to our real observations. This is 3 years of WMAP measurements. Probably seen this figure before. What this is the power spectrum of observations. So along here, we've got multiple L, which is basically angular scale, running from large scales to small scales. That's about a degree level of multiple 200. Up here is actually the square root of the power spectrum. So it tells you how big the fluctuations are in each of these components. And what we've got is the measurement of the temperature up here, which follows the standard pattern you'd expect from the CMB, where you have this acoustic oscillations at recombination laying down a specific pattern. And this is completely consistent with a simple lambda CDM model that could have been inspired by inflation. Two orders of magnitude down, we observe the E mode polarization signal. And it again has these acoustic peak signals from the density perturbations, acoustic and acoustic oscillations at recombination. It also has this peak here at very large scales, which comes from reionization at about a redshift of 11, where you also get a polarization signal from scattering of the CMB quadrupole off free electrons that arise at reionization of the universe reion axis. So we get this peak signal here, which has a different source from the rest of the signal up here at small scales. We also have the correlation between temperature and polarization here. But this signal is really very tiny. We're talking 0.2 microkelvin there, two orders of magnitude smaller than the temperature signal. And now here is a prediction of what we'd expect for the B mode if we have tensors at a level of, I think this one has 0.3, tensor scalar ratio of 0.3. It again has this peak at reionization, and then it has this signal from the point of the last scattering. And so all we've got so far is an upper limit of just over 0.1 microkelvin. And so we might think, okay, great. Now what we're going to do is, integrate longer with our telescopes, build fancier ones that are more sensitive, and just keep going after this tiny signal and just keep pushing us down. We've managed to come down from here to here. Why should we just keep going down a lot further? That's all we want to see.
So what is the meaning of the shaded regions? You have a
This is the errors due to cosmic variance. So because we've only got one sky, we're never going to be able to measure. So these scales are larger scales in the sky.
Yeah.
And so we've only got, for example, five measures of the quadrupole, for example, like the ALM, there aren't so many of them. And so we'll get error bars. Even if however long we integrate, we're never going to know those values to better than a certain level, because we've only got one sky to measure. So you can't get rid of these uncertainties.
Straight lines.
Yeah. I didn't really point them out, so this is what I'm going to be talking about much more. These are the foreground levels in terms of
the current foreground.
This is what I'm going to be showing you. I'm going to talk much more about this in a moment. But this is what the galaxy emits. The other thing I haven't pointed out, this is the lensing signal, where this signal gets lensed. Basically, E modes get skewed around to B modes because the matter in between the large scale structure lenses the signal into B modes. But this signal should be pure inflation.
What's the best resolution for the experiment?
What's the best resolution of what?
Of the measurements you can get. I see that you have one on the micro curtain.
Yeah.
Roughly slightly less than that. Mm. What can experiments get?
So right now people are building experiments. So at the moment with doubling that, just if we integrate a bit longer, we can get down to, we'll get down to this level. We'll get down to about, I think, this level with a few more years of data. But ground-based new polarization experiments are being built right now. For example, Quiet, Clover, and EBEX, different institutions, which they're more, because they're not full sky, because they're not satellite experiments, they won't be able to measure this very large scale. But they're kind of going after this signal here, and they should be able to measure down to about R of 0.01. So this corresponds to R of a tensor scalar ratio of 0.3, but they'll go down 10 orders, an order of magnitude smaller, basically. If it's there, they should be able to measure it, except for what I'm going to show you, which might cause a problem. Okay, because this is what the real data actually looks like, polarization. So WMAP measures in five frequency bands, ranging from 23 gigahertz up to 94 gigahertz. And so what these plots show you, these are galactic pictures of in galactic coordinates. So what each of them shows you is basically, you can imagine, basically in the middle, the galactic plane is along the center. So looking towards the center of each of these points, we're looking towards the center of the galaxy. And then top and the bottom of these figures are looking up to the north and south galactic poles. So we can imagine wrapping, if we take the galaxy or the full sky all around us, we imagine unwrapping it onto these projections and seeing it this way. And so what's plotted here is the magnitude and angle for the polarization. So forget about E and B modes for now. That's all we care about is Q and U Stokes vectors, which we actually measure. So we define Q Stokes vectors as polarization perpendicular and parallel to the galactic plane, and U Stokes vectors as offset at 45 degrees. And so the scale ranges from 0 to 50 microkelvin. So we just remember this figure, 50 microkelvin is up there. We're trying to measure this. It's going to get better because this one has the most signal from the galaxy. Basically, what you're seeing here is pure polarized galaxy. You're not seeing the CMB. It's completely dominated by the galaxy. So what we've got is a huge amount of polarization in the red from the galactic plane. So what's going on, again, this is something I didn't have any idea about before, is the galaxy is about 20 kiloparsecs in radius, and we're sitting about 8 kiloparsecs out from the center. So when we look towards there, we have 8 kiloparsecs to go to the center, and then 20 more kiloparsecs to go out to the other side. So this big bit of emission there is one of the spiral arms that's behind us, because it's wrapped around behind us. This bigger bit of emission there is a spiral arm in front of us, in between us and the center of the galaxy. And this big bit of emission up here is called the North Polar Spur. And it kind of looks like it's maybe right in the middle of the galaxy going up, but it's not. It's really, really close to us. It's like less than a kiloparsec away, and we think it's from this big supernova bubble that blew out a whole lot of stuff and this hugely polarized signal. And we'll talk more about the mechanism of what's going on. And then, so then if we go down from, and the polarization directions too, again, I'm going to talk more about MATLIS, is that, I don't know if you can see it properly, but they're all in the plane, completely perpendicular to the galactic plane there. They're not random. They trace these very nice coherent paths, even up in this north polar spur here, they go round in coherent loops and coherent directions. So the directions are not random. This is good. This is going to help us. And now we go down to higher frequency, and a signal from this from our galaxy drops. And this is because what's going on, I will show you some more. But essentially, you can think about it as if this is frequency. This is more the standard picture for the temperature. But we've got this basically, if this is about 60 gigahertz. You've got synchrotron emission dominating at low frequencies. It though reduces as we go up in frequency. And then what takes over is dust emission. And I'm going to talk more about these two processes in a minute. But you've basically got these two things in the galaxy that are going on. And the height and difference of these I will talk about. But the reason why we have all these different frequencies and what we're seeing is dropping here is the synchrotron emission is being reduced. I'll talk more about this. So as we go down from 23 to 33 to 41, reduces the galaxy emission drop. And down to 61 gigahertz, it looks not so big compared to there, but actually the emission from the galaxy is still pretty huge. And then finally 94 gigahertz, actually again the polarization slightly increases, and we see still this alignment of polarization in the plane. To show you even more that it's a problem.
What do those colors mean?
Oh, the colors is the magnitude of the polarization. So, sorry, wrong way. So, q to the squared of q squared plus u squared. So, if I say. So, if I measure the q and u Stokes vectors at any direction, I can then construct the magnitude and the polarization angle at any direction. And the scale is 0 to 50 microcal. So to go back to power spectra to show you, back to what Constantinus was asking, if I now show the multipole, and here now is the power spectra, not the square root of the power spectra, the total power spectra. These are signals we want to find. This has a realization optical depth of 0.09, and a tensor-to-scalar ratio of 0.3. It's incredibly optimistic. This is the actual observed signal. And this is removing the galaxy. This is removing anything that's very polarized. This is what we actually see. At the lowest frequencies, this huge signal, where solid is E and dashed is B. So it's like a 5 microkelvin level, whereas what we're after is 0.1 microkelvin. And even going down the frequencies to the least contaminated one, with least galactic emission, it still dominates. It's in this green line here. And we can estimate that at 60 gigahertz, this is the galactic signal in red up here, compared to what we're after down in black. So this is difficult. This is actually a problem. The good thing is, I'm going to reassure you, because these results we already put out, is we're confident that the way we actually removed the galactic signal so far has been fine. So what you can say, or what we said, was that I'll just go through this very quickly, actually, that we can say that lowest frequency band is pure synchrotron, and we can use that as a template for the galaxy to remove that. We can approximate the dust emission as using temperature maps of the dust with some polarization fraction and polarization directions that we get from optical starlight, I'll explain in a moment. Basically, with a very simple model with sort of three parameters or so, we can actually remove the majority of the polarized emission and get very clean maps and get a signal out for measurement of the optical depth polarization, for example, and an E-mode detection with a very simple cleaning process. And so this is just an image of pre-cleaned maps in Q-Stokes vectors and cleaned maps where you just have the CMB. And the goodness, the fit of the clean maps has a reduced chi-squared of, 1.01, 1.02, actually, 1.1 in Ka. So this is kind of where I came on board, because this won't really do for going much further. This will do for cleaning up E-mode maps, but we can still only use the least contaminated frequencies at the moment. We're not using our whole range of signals. And if we go to Planck, and if we go to these ground-based experiments, this is not really good enough. We don't really understand the emission from the galaxy well enough to, go after these really tiny B-mode signals from inflation. So,
I'm just sorry, I don't understand exactly what it means that the chi-squared bit to what?
Oh, it's saying
what is it compared to this? The prediction from the...
Oh, I see, sorry. It's
compared to what you'd expect from the GT.
It's saying how good a fit is my total signal to my model signal.
Oh, so it is the model.
Yeah, it's the model, yeah. So it's the difference of the total, so I take each of my maps, so I take the total Ka band map, for example, and I say how good is my model fit in each of the pixels.
Okay, but this doesn't involve you do the cleaning and then you compare. So it's not like you're tuning your cleaning so that you match your model.
No. Although you do tune the parameters that go into the cleaning to match your model. You do. I'm not quite sure about the question, but you do. Okay, so basically, I didn't really imagine a year ago that I would be interested in the galaxy. My interest is really in testing inflationary models, understanding the universe. I didn't really think that this would involve understanding what is going on in our galaxy and why it's polarized. But actually, this is kind of what we need to do if we're going to go after it. And so we need to understand the things we need to know about are actually predominantly in the galaxy. It's magnetic field. And the reason for this is it's the thing that breaks the isotropy of the galaxy. If the magnetic field was totally disordered or it wasn't there, then you would have no polarization in our galaxy at all. And there would be no problem. We just see the CMB signal. But because it is there, and it has a preferred direction, it's going to cause us problems. And I'll show you why. So that's the main thing we care about. The other two things we care about are energetic electrons. They're the things that are going to cause a synchrotron radiation. They're injected in supernovae, in star-forming regions, throughout the galactic plane. They then diffuse along magnetic field lines. So that's the second thing we care about. The third thing we care about is dust. We care a lot about dust. Dust is, I don't think I realise this either, what we're talking about here are tiny little micron-sized dust grains, less than tenth of a millimetre, all of them. And they are the thing that's actually going to produce emission at high frequencies. So this is just a little schematic of what I was describing before, that we're 8 kiloparsecs out from the centre, and we have these spiral arms both behind and in front of us that are producing emission. Okay, so the two things that we want to, what we can then do is, before we go and clean our maps, what we really want to understand is what the magnetic field looks like in the galaxy. Because if we can understand that, and we can really understand the physical process going on, we can then develop a way of understanding it better and how to figure out how to characterize it all better, clean our maps up better, and get after the real CMB signal. So I'm going to show you how we've constructed so far our best models of the planet magnetic field using the data we have already. So synchrotron radiation, what we've got is, just a reminder, is we have relativistic electrons spiraling in magnetic fields and then emitting radiation perpendicular to that. So at any given point in space, if I'm looking out to an electron and seeing its synchrotron radiation, I can decompose the magnetic field into a term that's parallel to my line of sight and two terms that are perpendicular to line of sight. And so any intensity signal, any temperature signal in terms of synchrotron intensity, is going to be a function of the electron density at that point and these two perpendicular components of the magnetic field. And then the Q and U Stokes vectors are simply going to be the difference between these two perpendicular components or this product, with an extra polarization fraction function that comes out to be about 3/4, 0.75. That'll be at any given point in space, if I look to a particular point in space. The spectrum of radiation depends on the energy distribution of these electrons. And typically, they're injected in these supernova with an energy spectrum that goes about as e to the minus 2. this comes out giving us an index of synchrotron radiation in terms of temperature that goes at about minus 2.5 or minus 3, which is why that cave, the low frequency maps are so contaminated. Then it's not quite as simple when we're actually looking through the galaxy, because what we see in terms of intensity and polarization is an integration along the whole line of sight, in direction through the galaxy, of the emission from each of those points. So we can integrate through with the number density of electrons, magnetic field at any given point, to observe the actual total integrated signal rather than a point at any given point. And then we can also measure the polarization angle as the ratio of these two points. And then the electrons at any given point in space, they're only injected in the galactic plane, but then diffuse out of the plane along field lines. So that's what we can actually see, synchrotron radiation from high up in the galaxy rather than just in the plane. Otherwise we just see it in the plane. So we actually understand the physics of this really well, but we don't know what this B field is, if you can try and construct it. And we don't know what the injection rate of electrons and their diffusion rate is either. But what we can see from these things is that if the magnetic field is in a given direction, for example, parallel to the plane, then the synchrotron emission is going to come out to be polarized exactly perpendicular to the plane. And this is what we see actually in the maps I showed you, is that right along the galactic plane, you see polarization directions lined up with the plane. So the second thing that depends very similarly on the magnetic field is thermal dust emission. So here now we have, again, dust predominantly in the galactic plane, tangled particles, and they're emitting radiation in a way that goes proportional. So the intensity is proportional to mu squared. So this is this increase at high frequencies. Now what's nice is that they actually, if you have grains and they're aspherical, they will line up to be perpendicular to the magnetic field. So if the fields go this way and you have long grains, they align perpendicular to that via this Davis-Greenstein mechanism, where they're kind of spinning around, and they preferentially will spin around with their the axis that has the greatest moment of inertia. spinning around that. So they end up spinning around the magnetic field that's going this way. So they'll align perpendicular to the field. What that means is that they will then emit radiation perpendicular to the field. And so they'll emit so that it will be completely, if we observe radiation from dust, we can infer the magnetic field must be exactly perpendicular to it. The other nice tool that we can use is that if we have stars behind the dust, then the dust grains will absorb starlight preferentially along that long axis. And we'll then emit, we'll observe stuff. The starlight we observe will be polarized parallel to the magnetic field, because the dust grains will absorb that stuff and will emit it in this direction. So if we can go and observe the polarization of starlight throughout our galaxy, then we can then use that to infer the magnetic field directions of the galaxy. So this is actually a really useful tool. Once again, we can then say, well, the polarization vectors we observe are going to be this integration throughout our galaxy of the dust density at any given point and the magnetic field perpendicular to our line of sight, the difference between those two directions at any given point. So what we can do now is is use the fact that we can exactly predict this to say, well, what do we see? And what can we infer from what we see, the direct polarization directions of our galaxy, to build up a model of the galactic fields? There's already going a lot of work in this area by radio astronomers who care a lot about these things that we didn't really care about before and now we care about. These are two images of M83 and M51, different galaxies, measured by these guys, Bielobinsky, Beck, Sofu, real magnetic field specialists. And what they see is that the field is basically follows the spiral arm structure. So this is polarized intensity and polarized directions, where you basically got this spiral field going around following the spiral galaxy and following the spiral arm structures very nicely. And here, again, is another example where you have a spiral galaxy and a field that traces around. Okay, so what we can now do is say, well, we can plug in some function that we think the magnetic field does look like. So this is an example of a logarithmic spiral arm structure, where I can specify the field at any point with this function, a function of r phi and z, where the total magnitude of the field is typically a few micrograms. And it can have various varying properties. So, for example, if I vary this function, this tells me how tightly wound my magnetic field spiral is going to be. And so I could have, for example, a more tightly wound structure, where here now we're looking in the galactic plane and saying what could the field be like in the plane. And it could have this tightly wound spiral structure. Or it could, for example, be more loosely wound, where the magnetic field, the field lines are not so tightly wrapped around. This field also has, this figure isn't very nice. This is now taking a slice through the galaxy, perpendicular to the plane. And we could say, well, the field lines go up like this, out towards the poles of the plane, or do they go out more shallowly? Like, how can we specify what this field looks like? I mean, this model is rather simple, because it doesn't have any, for example, north and south asymmetry around the plane, or possible field reversals where these things change direction, you know, go in and out and in and out, all these kinds of things. But what we can do is use this field with some model of where our electrons are to predict what the polarization angle should be from the galaxy, given this particular model. Okay, and so if I have a more tightly wound spiral, I will predict polarization angles, ignore the dark bits, just north, northern galaxy. I will predict these polarization angles for a given spiral, and I'll predict these polarization angles for a more loosely wound spiral, for example. And then I can go and look at the real data. So what I'm showing you here are the real polarization angles seen from the galaxy. This figure. So where this is the polarization angle gamma from the galaxy. I can then fit my magnetic field model. I vary all its variable parameters until I get angles, predicted angles that best match what I see. And actually you can see from this real figure that the angles, even though there's noise in there, It's remarkably coherent. It's not, this isn't just random angles. These do follow this pattern that might be predicted by a simple coherent field really quite well. And we get a good fit to this model, and we get find a field that has an opening angle of about 35 degrees, which was that first, which is quite tightly wound. And this isn't in complete agreement with what some other radio astronomers have said, which they think it's actually a magnetic field of about 8 degrees opening angle, for example. So this needs... this model could be refined, basically, and is being refined, and we should expect perfect agreement between the two if we have this. But the important thing is this is a coherent field does fit well. This isn't just random, which is really good news. We also see, this is a little noisy, that we said before that we expect to see the same polarization direction from both synchrotron emission and dust emission, because the two mechanisms produce the same polarized directions. So what I'm showing you here are basically the synchrotron emission low frequencies that has the same thing I showed you before with these coherent angles. And these are now measurements of polarized starlight, which trace the dust, okay, which should have the same angles from the same magnetic field. It's kind of, the data's not very great yet, but there is definitely a matching of angles. You can see here, there's very close agreement between how the angles match up. So this is sort of good confirmation that we're seeing the same field through both dust and through relativistic electrons. The other nice thing we can do, the thing is that we are in a much better position to learn about this field than radio astronomers. Okay, we actually have the CMB, we're in a new position, because what we don't suffer from is Faraday rotation, which is when we look through the galaxy, for example, at low frequencies, the polarization direction will be rotated round because different Hannah polarizations propagate at different speeds. And you can show that the angle that we rotated around, it's inversely proportional to the frequency squared. So if you have radio observations at low frequencies, the polarization direction will be rotated around, so basically wiped out completely. You won't be able to see what's going on. But up at CMB frequencies, the frequency is so high that we don't get any Faraday rotation. So we can now see what's going on in the plane in a way that no one else has been able to do so far. So this is just this is confirmation of that this is, again, the polarization angle I showed you from WMAP, 20 gigahertz. And this is the same thing down at 1.4 gigahertz measured by radio astronomers. And what you see is where the galactic field is big in the plane, the nice coherent behavior, and in particular the alignment of polarization vectors perpendicular to the plane, is just completely wiped out at low frequencies. It's gone. It's you can't tell what's going on there. But what's nice is what we're doing right now is that you only have a low amount of rotation up at the north and south poles. And so what we can do, something I'm doing right at the moment, is figuring out whether the field direction is the same, goes in the same way above the plane and below the plane. If it goes in different directions above and below, then they'll be rotated in opposite ways. So my rotation, I can measure how much the phase is rotated between here and here, and then the north and south, if they're different directions. The only reason why someone would care about that is that different motivations, people have different theories for how the magnetic field was formed in the first place, whether it was cosmological in origin or whether it was astrophysical. And so if you can determine whether or not the field is symmetric or asymmetric, it can help in distinguishing different models. This is just a useful tool that we have with our data. We can also figure out how coherent the field is. This is to show you one figure from this. If the field was really well behaved and was just this beautiful spiral, perfectly coherent, with no small-scale turbulence in the field, then we can predict exactly what the polarized signal we'd expect to see is. We'd expect it to be proportional to the intensity, but modified by this geometric factor, G sync, which comes from the fact that we're looking, integrating along lines of sight through this coherent spiral field. Now, some directions, the polarization directions will cancel, and you'll get nothing. And in some directions, it will be unaffected, depending on the geometric structure. And actually, what you find is this ranges from, just looking at this figure, ignore that one, you actually get a little suppression of the field here, but actually very little suppression elsewhere. So you could predict how big the polarized signal would be. Now, what we actually see in reality is the polarized signal is smaller by at least 50%. So what we can actually say, what we can conclude, is that there actually is a lot of tangled, incoherent fields, particularly in the galactic plane, because the polarized signal is so much smaller than the intensity. So we can start splitting up the field into this big coherent part and this incoherent part to figure out which things, how we should best model them. That's all I want to say about that. What we can also do with polarization, which is, I think, really fun, and a source of quite a lot of controversy at the moment within the CMB. Well, I think it's a bit controversial. that one, something we physically would really like to know is how the electrons, we like to know the variation of the synchrotron spectral index over the galactic sky for two reasons. One, we want to know if we should model it as a varying function spatially when we start cleaning up our maps. That's really important. But also, physically, this is an image of the spectral index between radio frequencies of 400 MHz and our lowest WMAP frequencies of 23 GHz. This is assuming that, and this is now back into temperature, where basically what we see is we see a shallow spectral index in the plane, steepening to a steep spectral index of about -3 off the plane. This is kind of like this makes sense physically. You've got electrons injected in the plane, they diffuse out, and physically expect them to get a steeper index way off the plane. But this is actually a source of massive uncertainty still in the temperature, because there could be a huge amount of spinning dust that I haven't spoken about. So that is another source of emission from the galaxy that might actually be in there, that the kind of current held view is it's not there, and everything we see at low frequencies is in temperature of synchrotron. This spinning dust component isn't polarized. So if we go and look at the polarization, and we don't see this pattern of massive steepening off the plane, then we can say, well, maybe there should be actually a huge amount of spinning dust in the temperature that's not there in the polarization. And we can use, these two things must agree. And whether there is this spinning dust component in the temperature needs to be resolved before we can go forward and really start picking up things like Planck data better. So what we're finding from the polarization is that perhaps there's evidence that we want them to agree. They don't necessarily agree. This is... Sorry. This is definitely something to be figured out. So I guess I want to discuss just briefly to come into the conclusions of what we can find in terms of astrophysics. Essentially, it's much more, if we just think about these components as we're just trying to clean foregrounds and we're just trying to get rid of our contamination from these two things we don't care about, synchrotron and dust, it's really not very exciting. What we've got from the CMB is a new way of telling us astrophysical properties of our galaxy. And so that, if we can actually exploit them, first of all, it's much more fun. There are things we can find out about a galaxy that no one else can figure out without CMB, without microwave data, then we're doing a lot better. And we really can figure these things out, I think, with map data, Planck data, and more. So we can figure out the coherent fields. We can model the fields and compare it, and using polarization directions that we observe, and using rotation measures between low frequency and high frequency, we can understand what the coherent field is. We can also understand how much the field is turbulent, again, by looking at how much the field, how much the galaxy is polarized, its fractional polarization, and by looking at the starlight directions. We can also work out whether it's connected to star-forming regions or not. These are all astrophysical things we'd like to know. I didn't think I wanted to know a year ago, but I actually would like to understand now. We'd like to know exactly where in the galactic plane the electrons are injected, and what is their energy distribution, and we can start figuring that out with spectral index measurements of the synchrotron. And we'd like to know how they cool and diffuse through the plane, which we can figure out with how the index varies as a function of latitude of the galaxy. We'd also like to know how much the dust grains align with the magnetic field. Do they really line up to be exactly perpendicular to the field? And how aspherical are they? And we can figure that out by looking at the polarization at these high frequencies. And we'd also like to know if there's emission from spinning dust particles, very tiny particles that could actually be contributing a lot of the emission down at low frequencies that we thought was synchrotron. And by combining temperature and polarization measurements, we can actually figure out whether it's there or not. So these are the kind of astrophysical things that we want to know, and we are going to get a better handle on. But obviously, if you just care about getting back to inflation and measuring those BMOs, then you think, well, why do we really need to know all these things? Could we just forget about all the physics of them, forget about knowing about the field, the electrons, the dust, and just, you know, clean up our maps using kind of statistical techniques? We could do that. But I think that's not really good enough, because the better we know the physics of what's going on, the simpler we'll be able to characterize the galactic polarized emission. We need to know whether we should be, you know, using spatially varying, frequency varying spectral indices to model these components. We want to know how many of them we need. We want to know if we had no idea, if the magnetic field across the sky was completely incoherent, we'd need different spectral indices and different polarization fractions all over the sky, and we would have no chance of extracting them without, you know, having 40 frequencies to measure over. But actually, we find that the galaxy model is quite simple. The galaxy is quite well behaved, and maybe we need fewer parameters to describe the galaxy. So these all feed it. So our knowledge of what's going on really feeds in to how well, to how simply we can describe the emission, how simply we can describe the polarization directions and their fractions over the sky, and also importantly whether we expect, for example, the temperature and polarization to have the same, you know, if they've got synchrotron, do we give them the same index at a given point in the sky? Someone, without thinking about it, you might say, of course, they should have the same index. It's the same emission function. But imagine a scenario where you had, come here. Say you were looking here, and say you had this whole like tangled field here, and then this coherent field over here. You would see temperature emission from every single point through this galaxy. But you'd only see polarization coming from out here, because any polarization that came from here would be completely wiped out by the polarization direction of the field. So if, for example, you had like loads of star-forming regions in here, and the index was different to the index over here, then your integrated signal in polarization would be different to the temperature. So that's unlikely, but it's possible. And so you have to, understanding that will help you understand how much variation to put in. Knowing what's going on physically also means you can get find regions with low galactic polarization, good for designing ground-based CFD experiments, and also helps us understand how to combine low-frequency radio measurements into our sort of cleaning mechanism, knowing how much they're contaminated by Faraday rotation and where they will be least contaminated. So we're going in both directions. One is better astrophysical knowledge, and the second is how does that come back in to help us improve our cleaning up of the maps. And it's still, you know, work in progress, certainly. But it's going to kind of dominate, I think, the next few years of CMB work. So just to summarize, we do have, we want to see gravitational waves if we're going to have convincing evidence that inflation happens. That's really the challenge of CMB at the moment. But understanding the polarized emission from our galaxy is going to be vital if we succeed. So we've passed, the CMB has passed all tests of inflation so far, and we need to do the B-modes. The microdata is actually a new way of measuring the galactic magnetic field because it's not dominated by Faraday rotation, it's not contaminated. And what we find is this nice, partially coherent spiral field structure fits the data very well. But we really need to understand the field better and know what's going on with the cosmic ray electrons and the dust if we're to really test inflation. And it's definitely, I think, going to be much more interesting for us if we care about the astrophysical conclusions we can draw at the same time as statistically cleaning up our maps. So that's where we are at the moment.
We're in this quadrant, we'll have very long ocean in this case, so we'll see completely different quadrant if you look at high order.
Right, I see. Yeah, I understand. But you could use the gaussianity of the total signal.
You have the same signal, it's completely galaxy.
Yeah. It's not something that we've explored. You would actually expect to be on Gaussian. Yeah. That's an interesting question. Whether you can take the total map and try and subtract out the any non-Gaussian component of it. And I imagine it's true, but I haven't investigated that. It's interesting. Yeah. Good point.
And my other question is, so what you're doing is you're cleaning the map based on some model.
Mm.
Then you create some software, like you could where people can use it with the CMB.
Mm.
So that already uses the clean map. Wouldn't be, can I have something where you're feeding both the CMB and the model at the same time?
Oh, I see. So it depends what you're doing. I mean, when we've been fitting the model, we've been using, for in terms of the magnetic field model, we've just been using the lowest frequency, which is completely dominated by galactic emission. So you could, but then when you're trying to extract just simply what's the total galactic signal from the CMB, you would then use all the frequencies. It depends what you're trying to do. Like if you're trying to get the magnetic field by itself, you might as well just use the one that's dominated by the synchrotron emission, because you know it's basically all synchrotron. There's no point in a fit for the CMB at the same time.
Right.
So it's only if you care about the CMB that you want to combine all the frequencies, because then it's such a tiny signal and you won't see it. So I think it depends what you want. If you want to... I don't think is reasonable at the moment is to put in a model for the magnetic field and use that to clean the maps. We haven't been using that so far. We're not at that point yet. I think you need to, at the moment, it's an intermediary stage. It's like you best model the galactic field, and then you say, given that, how many parameters should I use to describe spatial variation and indices and that kind of thing, and then clean the maps. I think in the future, perhaps, you could put in a model for the fields and a model for the electron distribution and for the dust distribution, and then fit those parameters at the same time with the CMB. But we're not there yet.
So what's the back to the B-mode polarization in the CMB? Is the major holdup doing this sort of work, or is it actual and everyone?
It depends. It's both at the moment. I just think it depends on experiments. So With us, our sensitivity is not that high, and so we could reasonably, if R is 0.13 or whatever, then we could see it with 8 years of WMAP. But then the holdup will definitely be this cleaning, definitely. With the next generation of experiments that can go even more sensitive. I think this will still be a limiting factor. Because if you don't see them, then it's okay, you can just keep putting upper limits. You don't have to really worry about this, because if you see nothing, then you say, well, I've cleaned it fine, and there's nothing there. But if you see evidence for them, then I think, and no one is going to claim a 3-sigma detection until they are really sure about this cleanup. And so I think that will be the point at which things stagnate, and we need to understand this better.
Yes, or something like Clover or Quiet. Because they live in much smaller patches, right?
So yeah.
You can't pick aren't quiet enough spots. They need some
control. They're pretty confident that they're quiet enough spots. For example, Quiet is only observing two frequencies at 40 and 90.
Just sort of one to catch the
program. Then they're going to have to really be sure they look at a low dust emission region, because there's going to be synchrotron. And so then you have to say, well, I'm just going to look for low dust and assume that there's any synchrotron, and then clean. And to be sure that the plots I showed you saying that the emission is higher of the entire sky at all angles is not completely true if you miss out if you look for clean regions. But I think they're going to have to be probably sure than they are at the moment.
Right. Are they going to be able to use, whenever you finish doing your human's work and map all of this stuff up, is that going to make their job a lot easier?
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully it will. I think.
Even though the WMAP doesn't have that fine scale resolution,
this
is going to be good enough to help.
It's going to help, but then they will probably also have new problems in terms of the fact that with our beam, we smear, if there's like polarization in different directions in a little patch of sky, we smear that out. And so if there really is very small scale turbulence in the field, then you could have like, it would really start messing up in those, but it doesn't bother us. And so actually it might then get trickier again in terms of how you need to describe it. Yeah.
Thank you.